Hello, I'm John Dennis. It's Friday the 17th of July. Today, a showcase for environmentally friendly living. The government gives the green light for four eco-towns.
When the best technologies have been proven, they'll obviously then become cheaper for the rest of us to take on board.
Human rights activists say the murdered campaigner Natalia Estemirova was assassinated by the Chechen president.
Kadyrov pulled her in last year and basically threatened her and kind of personally attacked her, but she carried on regardless.
And meet l'Orchestra di Piazza Vittorio, an orchestra of immigrants in one of the most right-wing cities in Europe.
Everything you can imagine has happened between us, but over the years that has solidified this to a real group.
Guardian Daily with John Dennis on guardian.co.uk.
But first, it's Bill Overton with the headlines and a look at the papers.
29 people have now died in the UK after contracting swine flu, and the chief medical officer is warning the virus could kill between 20 and 65,000 people. Seasonal winter flu in 1999 caused more than 20,000 deaths. The Cabinet's Emergency Planning Committee, COBRA, is meeting three times a week to prepare for the impact of the rapidly spreading pandemic. A dedicated internet service and helpline has been set up that will involve 2,000 people in call centres giving out advice and prescribing antiviral drugs. The helpline, which will open later this week, is intended to relieve pressure on GPs and hospitals. At least nine people have been killed in two bomb blasts at luxury hotels in the Indonesian capital, Jakarta. One explosion hit the Ritz-Carlton and the other at the Marriott Hotel. At least 48 people have been injured. A third blast went off almost 3 hours later in the north of the city. No injuries have yet been reported. The Manchester United football team was scheduled to stay at the Ritz on Saturday and Sunday night for a friendly match against the Indonesian All-Stars. Dmitry Medvedev has rejected claims by Russian human rights groups that Chechnya's president Ramzan Kadyrov was responsible for the murder of a prominent human rights activist. Russia's president says her killing had been committed to discredit the Kremlin. Natalia Estemirova was abducted from her home in Grozny on Wednesday morning. She was found in neighbouring Ingushetia with bullet wounds to the head. Thousands of postal workers across the UK are staging a 24-hour strike today. Many more will join demonstrations in an escalating row over jobs, pay and services, threatening the worst disruption to mail deliveries for years. The Communication Workers Union says more than 12,000 of its members in areas including London, Edinburgh, Bristol, Darlington and Plymouth will be taking part. An American teenager has become the youngest person to sail around the world alone. Zach Sunderland, who's 17, completed the 28,000-mile voyage in 13 months, facing storms, equipment breakdown and suspected pirates. A younger sailor, Mike Perham from the UK, is expected to complete his own round-the-world trip in about 3 weeks' time. Now let's take a look at the morning papers, and the latest warnings on swine flu are dominating the front pages. It's getting serious, warns the Mail, reporting NHS plans to deal with 350 deaths a day. The Express has the same figures and talks of grim predictions that could see 10% of the population ill by the end of August. The Sun goes a step further and says a third of people in the UK could get the bug. They add the news that Cherie Blair has fallen ill with the H1N1 virus. The Times has details on which areas of the country are worst hit, naming the London borough of Tower Hamlets as the place with the most GP visits. The Independent has chosen instead to look at the death of human rights activist Natalia Estemirova in Russia. They lead with an article she wrote before her death about murders and abductions in Chechnya. The only other story to make any of the front pages is the continuing row over helicopter shortages in Afghanistan. The Mirror has a picture of the funeral of Lieutenant Colonel Rupert Thornelow, who was killed by a bomb in Afghanistan. Army Chief Sir Richard Dannett has said troops are being let down by lack of equipment. And the Telegraph goes on to report that ministers are planning a revenge attack on his reputation as soon as he leaves his post next month. You can keep up to date on all the breaking news and sport throughout the day at guardian.co.uk.
The government has given the go-ahead for the first four eco-towns to be constructed in the UK. They're at Whitehill Borden in Hampshire, China Clay Community at St Austell in Cornwall, Rackheath in Norfolk and North West Bicester in Oxfordshire. Each will consist of 10,000 homes featuring state-of-the-art energy-saving technology. There'll be charging points for electric cars on the streets and lots of cycle routes and easy access to public transport. With the details is Alok Jha, The Guardian's green technology technology correspondent.
So these eco-towns are meant to be showcases for how we might live if we do have this sort of low-carbon society of the future. So things like charging points on cars, city planning, so that where you live is not very far away from public transport, for example. They want to make sure that less than half of the journeys are car journeys. They want to make sure that there are local heat networks, so combined heat and power plants, to supply maybe a few thousand homes so that you can share the heat as well as the energy from there. They're much more efficient in terms of carbon. And things like that, zero carbon homes, the best energy efficiency. So a real showcase for people. And the idea is you have a few of these. They want, I think, 10 by 2020. They've announced four yesterday. When the best technologies have been proven, they'll obviously then become cheaper for the rest of us to take on board.
And what difference will they make to tackling global warming?
Well, homes, the energy use in homes accounts for something like a quarter of the UK's carbon emissions. I mean, that's a huge amount. That's 10 times aviation. I mean, people forget this. Actually, that the world will be saved by loft insulation, essentially. If we all put loft insulation in, we will actually save more carbon than any sort of increase in air passenger transport. Don't quote me on that.
It's been recorded. It's too late for that.
But it's massively, bigger. So there's a huge prize. And stuff like these eco-towns, if they work, then you could essentially have zero carbon homes, zero carbon lifestyles at home, essentially. And you know, if you could knock off half of that, even that's the same as all road transport, for example. 12% of the carbon emissions in the country come from road transport. You know, that's a huge prize.
Are eco-towns the best way of creating these homes, though? Because the campaign to protect rural England says the government should concentrate on existing properties and doing up brownfield sites.
Well, at the risk of agreeing with the campaign for rural England, the thing is that they have a point. There are lots of places where you could start this. You don't have to start from scratch somewhere where it's not wanted. I mean, there's no point building this where people don't want it. And what the campaigners against them have argued is that if you have these new homes, because they want 10,000 new homes, if you want these places, then perhaps they're not going to look great next to these market towns. So, you know, I think that if the locals don't want them, they shouldn't be built there. But frankly, we need to do this stuff. And the only people who don't want this stuff happening are people, you know, the not in my backyard people. This is the best, one of the best ways to tackle climate change. And anyone who sort of disagrees with it, I think, is just not looking forward 50 years when the rest of the world is covered into 2 meter sea rises and things because we didn't tackle climate change.
This isn't the end of the road, as it were, for eco towns, though, is it? Because they still need planning permission.
Yeah.
And the Conservatives might win the next election. They say eco towns are a gimmick.
But what are they going to replace them with? Is my question. They have to have something to do with homes. They've been quite bold in their low carbon strategy, actually, the Tories, about saying that every home in the country is going to get £6,000 to make sure that they're more energy efficient and are using the right sorts of technologies to reduce their carbon footprints. Don't be just because they're down on eco towns. It doesn't mean they're down on the environment. They're quite bold. Whether eco-towns are the best way, therefore, and what the Tories do, I don't know. I mean, these eco-towns won't be built till 2016, so who knows if they will ever be built. But I think that it's important that we step in those directions. And actually, if they do get started, and if enough people don't complain and things, the NIMBYs sort of are kept away, then, you know, I think it'd be a good thing even if two of them get on board and we learn a few lessons which we then can translate to the rest of our housing stock.
Alok, many thanks. Alok Jha, and there's full coverage at guardian.co.uk/environment. Also on The Guardian's website today, Martin Amis on Iran. That's at guardian.co.uk/books. Marina Hyde considers Trudy Styler's yoga video, and Heather Mills on This Morning. That's at guardian.co.uk/lostinshowbiz. And Stuart Jeffries looks at what he says is Graham Norton's underwhelming career. guardian.co.uk/media. Natalia Estemirova, a Russian human rights campaigner, was abducted and shot dead in Chechnya on Wednesday. She was a close friend of Anna Politkovskaya, the journalist and critic of the Kremlin, who was shot dead outside her Moscow flat in 2006. Human rights activists in Russia say that a few months ago, Chechnya's president, Ramzan Kadyrov, personally threatened Natalia Estemirova. Luke Harding reports from Moscow.
Well, Natalia Estemirova was really one of Russia's most famous human rights activists. And I have to say, an astonishingly brave and inspiring and remarkably serene woman who, in the face of colossal intimidation and, I think, state terror, performed a kind of heroic service in Chechnya. She worked for Memorial, which is Russia's oldest human rights organization, and she lived permanently in Grozny. And really, she just sort of reported on the kind of numerous human rights abuses which were taking place there under Ramzan Kadyrov, Chechnya's president and a close ally of Vladimir Putin. And she carried on. She knew the risks from what she was doing. Kadyrov pulled her in last year and basically threatened her and kind of personally attacked her. But she carried on regardless. And then, of course, on Wednesday, she was abducted from outside her house in Grozny and then executed, shot in the head and chest, and dumped by the side of the road.
And her fellow human rights campaigners say that Kadyrov was responsible for her murder.
Yes, at a press conference in Moscow yesterday, Oleg Orlov, who's the head of Memorial, and Ludmila Alexeyeva, who is a Soviet-era dissident and possibly the most respected human rights activist in Russia, both directly accused Kadyrov of being responsible. They also blamed Vladimir Putin, Russia's prime minister, and said that essentially by backing Kadyrov, he'd created a sort of just a kind of nightmarish permissive regime in Chechnya where extrajudicial killings could take place, where people's houses could be burnt down, and where human rights abuses were rampant. So very, very strong words from them. And interestingly enough, this provoked a response from Dmitry Medvedev, who yesterday was in Germany meeting Angela Merkel. And although Medvedev has condemned Estimirova's death, he described the theory that Kadyrov was somehow involved as primitive and unacceptable.
And Kadyrov himself denies anything to do with the murder.
Yes, he says this is merely an attempt to discredit Chechnya and Russia in general. Now, I have to say this is a somewhat tarred line that we've heard on many other occasions. You have to bear in mind that Natasha was close friends with Anna Politkovskaya, who got shot dead in Moscow in 2006. And we had the same theory then, that basically it's the Kremlin's enemies who bump off all these human rights activists, lawyers and journalists to try and discredit the Kremlin. Now, I'm reporting on these kinds of stories with depressing regularity, John. I have to say, I had lunch with Natasha in February. She came to Moscow to attend the Politkovskaya trial of four people who were accused of involvement in her murder. And, you know, we sat in a German beer cellar and we talked about England. She was very fond of England and liked Oxford, and talked about her work in Chechnya. And she really was, she was an amazing woman. And the fact that someone of her caliber can be shot dead, just snuffed out brutally, really says a lot about the lamentable state of human rights in Russia at the moment.
Guardian Daily. News and reports from around the world.
My name's John Dennis. Coming up in Guardian Daily, The Ashes, Mike Selvey's view of the first day of the second test at Lourdes. But first, the murder rate in England and Wales has fallen to its lowest in 20 years. The annual crime figures show that there were 648 homicides in 2008-09, and that's 136 fewer than in the previous year. Alan Travis is our Home Affairs editor.
Oh, well, unfortunately, the Home Office can't yet give us an explanation of the breakdown of those murder figures. It's quite a dramatic fall. They say it's not a blip, that it is a sustained and serious drop. It doesn't seem to be the only subcategory which we have any figures on for knife crime, stabbings, fatal stabbings, but they've only fallen by about 12, and this drop is about 136 year on year, so that's only a very small proportion. Possibly they suggest advances in medical science means that they're actually able to save the lives of people who they would have lost a few years ago, perhaps from stab wounds or gunshot wounds. But the rest of the crime figures do show another substantial fall in gun crime, down 17%. And it may be some of the significant fall is due to fewer shootings.
What about the effects of the recession on crime?
Well, we had expected this set of crime figures, which covers the 12 months to the end of March this year, i.e. both quarters in which the economic recession officially took place, to have had some visible impact on the crime rate, driving it upwards. And in the previous set of figures, domestic burglaries had risen by 4%. But in this set of figures, it only goes up by 1%. And there's a couple of other categories of crime, such as credit card and online fraud up about 5% and shoplifting up 10%. But they're small when considering the overall. So it seems as though that there's been a very limited impact upon the recession, on the underlying crime rate of the recession so far.
And we talked about murder, but what about other violent crimes?
Yes, as I mentioned, there's some impressive reductions in gun crime, down 17% to about 7,000 odd incidents involving a gun in the last year. Knife crime, however, looks on these figures to have remained fairly stable in the last 12 months, despite some rather high-profile claims from the government in recent months that they were having, based upon accident emergency figures that they rushed out and were heavily criticised by the statistical chiefs for, but they claimed they were having some real breakthrough successes in the highest knife crime areas.
And what does the British Crime Survey say about the way that people perceive crime?
Well, it's interesting that despite the fact that we've now had a longest sustained fall in crime in this country in our history from 1995, 14 years of year-on-year reduction in the national crime figures, 75% of people still believe, they tell the pollsters, the British Crime Survey, that crime nationally is going up. So the government's failed to get that message across. But locally, it's interesting, the big split between how people feel about crime in their own neighbourhood and how they feel about the country as a whole, only a third of people feel that crime is going up where they live, although three quarters will tell you it's going up nationally. Interestingly, also on antisocial behaviour, perceptions of antisocial behaviour, which the new Home Secretary, Alan Johnson, says he's very keen to make his priority. He's recently said that the government had been coasting and complacent about antisocial behaviour, but it's interesting, during that period, proportion of people who felt that the police and local councils were doing a good job on antisocial behaviour has actually gone up from 45% to 49%. So it looks as though coasting might be actually a better policy.
Alan, many thanks. L'Orchestra di Piazza Vittorio perform at the Barbican in London tonight. Their 15 musicians include Arabs, Latin Americans, Africans, Europeans, an American, and musicians from the Indian subcontinent. Between them, they speak 8 languages and play music in a variety of genres. But the miracle is they're based in the heart of Europe's most conservative capital, Rome. John Hooper reports.
In a rehearsal studio in Rome, an orchestra is playing, well, see if you can guess. Succession of chords from what sounds like an ordinary Western band soon gives way to Indian tabla drumming, which in turn leads into an ethereal melody sung in Arabic. What is it? Believe it or not, Mozart's magic flute, rendered in the unique style of the Orchestra Piazza Vittorio, a band composed largely of immigrants to Italy, that plays what I can only call globalised music. It was founded 7 years ago by a rock musician, Mario Tronco.
Dopo l'11 settembre gli stranieri erano tutti nemici.
After 9/11, he told me, foreigners were enemies, and yet I knew that historically, and particularly where music was concerned, cultural differences had produced wonderful things. It was the moment to try to put together all, or at least most, of the cultures on the peninsula and try to create a new sound.
I was thinking he was definitely mad.
Pino Pecorelli, a fellow rock musician who had to be won over to Tronco's enterprise, one that has required an immense amount of mutual accommodation by the musicians.
Every time we approach to a new song, it seems to be a drama. Like, how we can do this? How we can understand this? How I can understand this? But every time, now, after 7 years, everyone is finding his own way of interplay with the other.
And living with him or her too. The musicians have 11 nationalities and speak 8 languages.
A lo mejor tenemos que ir a un restaurante a comer.
If, for example, we go to a restaurant to eat and I fancy eating pork, said the Cuban trumpeter, Omar López Valle, I probably won't do so because of the other lands who are Muslims.
That's actually 99% of what made us a group, where all of the debates we had and all sorts of things and rooming together and...
And quite a few rows, I imagine, at the beginning.
Yes.
John Maida, the orchestra's U.S. violinist.
Everything you can imagine has happened between us, but over the years that has solidified this to a real... we are a real group. We know each other inside and out, and all of us have also played individually with the other musicians as well. So it really is a family.
John Hooper reporting. Well, now cricket and the Ashes. After the first test in Cardiff, England were hoping to improve their batting performance against Australia. Here's Mike Selvey on the first day of the second test at Lord's, talking to Guardian Daily's Peter Sale.
They improved up to a point, up to a 196 run point, really, the opening partnership between Andrew Strauss and Alistair Cook. 196 runs, that's a record for England against Australia at Lord's. That's the best possible start, and at a fair old lick as well. Australians were a rabble, to be frank. They were awful. Mitchell Johnson in particular bowled dreadfully, and Alistair didn't really have to bat that well to find the boundaries off him as he did. But I'm afraid that was really about as good as it got. Australians found their feet thereafter. Started to bowl better. They were held together by the bowling of Ben Hilfenhaus, who I thought bowled excellently well. He bowled as well as the others bowled poorly. Thereafter, England wicket started to tumble, and with Andrew Strauss watching at the other end, a few flash shots and some indecisive batting, and suddenly 6 wickets tumble for 137 runs, and so the initiative rather thrown away.
One of those wickets, Andrew Flintoff, he'd have been hoping for better in his first appearance since announcing his retirement.
Yeah, knowing Fred as we do, we expect that he'd notch it up another to another level. He'd want to go out with a bang in his career. We don't want this to turn into a valedictory trip around the countryside for him. We want him to actually perform, and he played a rather insipid shot, to be honest, to get out an edge to second slip, and not helpful to the cause, really. When it's the sort of time for him to come in where we needed a big innings from Flintoff. They didn't really need to seize the initiative. I mean, scoring really well, although 364 from 90 overs is a pretty heady scoring rate. But we'll now be expecting it from him with the ball.
Mike Selvey. Guardian Daily is produced today by Peter Sale and Harriet Grant. My name's John Dennis. Thanks for listening.